Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Are you ready? Welcome to a great Tuesday evening we have here on Suspense Radio. So glad everybody could join us. We have a very, very exciting show for you tonight. First up, we're going to have New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, who's going to be talking about his latest release, which just hit stores today, The Emperor's Tomb, along with a very exciting trip he took over the USO with David Morrell and James Rollins and Andy Harp to visit the troops over in the Middle East, and that's going to be great. We're also going to talk with author Joel Fox later tonight with his book that came out called Lincoln's Hand. So everybody, my name is John Robb. I am your host. It's time for you to sit back, relax, enjoy, because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us here on this great Tuesday night we have on Suspense Radio. A couple quick announcements before we get to Steve. We want to let everybody know that the December issue is going to be in bookstores here the Thursday after Thanksgiving. I believe that's December 2nd, if my calendar is correct. So you want to make sure you check that out because that's our best of edition for 2010. Where all of our best of books are going to be, you know, in their author's genre, breaking it down. A couple announcements also is November the 30th, Patricia Cornwell and Michelle Gagan are going to be on the show. December the 2nd, it's a 30-minute special here with John Saul. We also have on December the 7th, Brad Thor is going to be on. So you want to make sure that you check out the website to see everybody that's coming up because we have a lot of exciting guests, a lot of exciting things coming on here at Suspense Radio. And December the 3rd, we are doing a debut author, so only debut authors are going to be on. I'm going to try to get maybe two, maybe three on there to talk about their books, to give them their time to be able to do it, because it is a long haul to be able to become, you know, a very successful published author. Excuse me, still getting over a cold. And, you know, speaking of long haul, our first guest here, New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, had his own long haul to finally get to where he's at. And it's great to be able to say that today The Emperor's Tomb comes out today. I just got done with the book signing. And, Steve, I want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing tonight?
Doing fine. It's been a long day, but it's been a good day. We've done a lot of press today, and then I did an event tonight. So it's 9 o'clock out where I am.
Right, yeah. And like I was talking, we're having that thing coming on December the 3rd with new authors because, you know, your success finally with Emperor's Tomb, I mean, with all your books, because you had The Balkan Escape, which was an ebook original, which is something very exciting that you first did. But your new Cotton Malone book here, Emperor's Tomb, Can you just give everybody a little background of the Emperor's Tomb and, you know, kind of how it, you know, how the book kind of is and how it unfolds a little?
Yeah, it's kind of the sixth adventure, and this is going to mark the return of Cassiopeia Vitch. She's been gone from a couple of books, so she's back this now. Her and Cotton's relationship is going to go through some changes. I'm not going to say whether they're good or bad, but there's some definite changes coming in their relationship. This book deals with something very interesting, though. It deals with the first emperor's tomb in China. The first emperor's tomb is the one guarded by the terracotta warriors that we all know about. The tomb sits about a kilometer away from the warriors. It's been there for 2,200 years. It's the greatest archaeological site in all of China. Yet the Chinese government will not allow any digging and no one to enter that tomb.
That's shocking that the Chinese won't allow that to happen.
That fascinated me. Why?
I know.
Why do they keep this site sealed off? So I sent Cot Malone over there to find out.
And, of course, Cot Malone did his normal Cot Malone stuff, and we can't say whether he did or didn't because we read the book and, you know, people got to figure it out. But, I mean, it's very exciting time, you know, because this is the sixth book in the Cot Malone series, and he's progressed. You know, how would you say that Cotton has progressed from his first book until now into his sixth, and of course, what you're working on and beyond?
He's definitely changed since Templar Legacy. That was the first book. Alexandria Link, we learned about him and his ex-wife and his family a little bit. Venetian Betrayals, where him and Cassiopeia first started to build something there. And then in the Charlemagne Pursuit, it was a very personal story. He dealt with his father and what happened to his father 30 years ago. And in the Paris Vendetta, he had to deal with his friend Henrik Tervallesen and a conflict that he had there where he had to choose between friend and country. So Cotton has progressed in every story. He's kind of grown. He's changed a little bit. His character's changed a little. But I want to make clear to the readers, you don't have to read these books in order. You can read them and go back and forth. I wrote them in that way where they wouldn't be a problem. They don't give away anything. They don't spoil anything. So you can go back and forth and check them out and see just how Cotton has progressed.
Right. And that is the great thing about your character because, you know, Cotton, now that in a sixth book and the way that he, you know, has gone through with his own personal emotions of these different demons or things that he's had to progress, not only with, you know, solving, you know, the historical part of whatever's in the book, but his own personal thing, it is good because, yeah, you don't have to read them technically. You don't have to read them in order because it's not like a timeline. You didn't write it like a timeline, which is very smart of you.
Yeah, they're easy to go back and forth. If you read them in order, you'll recognize some things, but if you don't, it won't be a problem. And that's the challenge of writing a series. You have to try to make each one the same but different. That's the key. It has to be the same but different. It's very very difficult balance to do, but I'm trying to do it. I'm working hard at it. There'll be a seventh one next year, so you know, there's a lot more to go with Cotton.
And then with all that you had going on, you also put out The Balkan Escape, which was an ebook original, which you know, had your character Cassiopeia Vit in it. I mean, what made you decide to go ahead and do this as an ebook original?
Well, it was too short to put out as a book. It's only 6,000 words, and it was a story about her, and it fills in a gap from the novel. It's something in the novel I didn't include. But it fills in a gap in the novel that when you read the novel and if you read the short story, you go, oh, I see where that goes now. But if you read the short story first, it will whet your appetite for the novel. I wrote it where you could read it either way. And it's just we had this story. We wanted to try it. The ebook format is becoming very big now. So we wanted to take a crack at it. But for those readers out there who don't do ebooks, It will appear in the back of the paperback for The Emperor's Tomb next summer, and you can check it out then.
Nice. So how did the ebook kind of thing, you know, how well did it work? I mean, was it something that you're like, you know, this is very interesting because, you know, probably your good friend from the International Thriller Writers, David Morrell, did his book, The Naked Edge, in straight ebook form.
He went straight there to do it. It's done very well. The Balkan Escape sold quite a few, a lot of copies. Of course, it was only $1.59, so it's very reasonably priced. And
right.
It's still out there for anybody who, with your ebook reader, to check it out and download it, give you a good taste of Cassiopeia and get you, maybe, as I said, whet your appetite to want to get more into it and see and read The Emperor's Tomb or some of the other books in the Cot Malone series in which Cassiopeia appears. So she's a very strong-willed character, very interesting character. I wanted to give her a story of her own, and we thought we'd try it out first with an e-book.
And do you see this possibly being something where you take a secondary character and do a short story like this, like a 6,000-word kind of thing in ebook outside of Cotton Malone to kind of see how that works if you're going to maybe do, you know, parallel series with somebody else?
I might do some more short stories like this to fill in some gaps or plug a hole that I left in the novel intentionally, something like that. You may do it. They're short, so we can't print them. And that's where the ebook format is so wonderful, because you can put out a short formatted story at a really cheap price. I mean, $1.59, and the reader can enjoy it and also maybe get themselves interested in wanting to read more. So I'm not going to rule out that we may not do it again.
And unlike like David, when he did his on straight Kindle, the Balkan Escape is available on any ebook reader that people have. So you can get on Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Any MP3 player, Sony, the Nook, anything, it's out there. And it's also, there's an Audible, unabridged audio version as well.
Oh, so now, is that something, did you read it? Or did someone
I did
else?
Not read it. No, I think Scott Brick read it. He reads most of my stuff. So,
okay.
The Audible version is out there and is available. So if anybody does, as I said, the audio books, they can certainly go there and download it. I think it's like $3.95. It's not bad at all.
So now, before we get into the next exciting thing that you just came back from, you said that your next book is coming out next year, and it's going to be another Cotton Malone book. And again, is this another, because your books deal with historical places that a lot of people have never written about or at all written about. Is this one kind of the same kind of premise, another just totally one that people are going to be just surprised at seeing?
This is a new story. It's his very first domestic adventure. He's going to come home to America for an adventure, and it deals with a clause in the United States Constitution that I guarantee you 99% of America has no clue is in there. It's a very unique, interesting, somewhat shocking clause in our Constitution that I fashioned a thriller around.
And like you, with a lot of historical fiction writers that write, and what you're very good at too is you put in the books so a lot of people know what was the factual and what was the fictional part. I know that when my wife reads it, she loves to get to the end to see exactly what you do to say, okay, this was factual, but this was fiction. And I think a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, that was real? Oh, that was not real? I mean, so
that's what I like. I love my writer's note at the end. I spend a lot of time on that. It takes me about a week to write that writer's note, which is only about 2,500 words. Normally I could write that in about 2-3 days. And it takes me a good solid week or more to write it, because I go through every page, try to find everything. I want the reader to know what's real and what's not. It's not fair for them not to know that. So I always make it. But I always tell people, please don't read it first. It will give away the whole novel.
And, you know, and again, aside from maybe, you know, spy political things, you have to do a lot of research. And a lot of people always ask, like with any kind of questions with historical writers, how much on-location research do you do, like for the Emperor's Tomb that just came out today for everybody, that you did for, you know, for you, that you do for your books?
Well, this particular book was a little bit unique. Usually I make one major trip per book. I went to France for Templar. I went to Venice for the Venetian Betrayal. I went to Portugal for Alexandria Link and Germany for the Charlemagne Pursuit. All of them I made a trip. This one I didn't make a major trip. I did go to Antwerp, but it wasn't I did go there, but I didn't go to China, which is where this book takes place. I didn't have the time to spend the 30 days to go. I couldn't go. So I had to do my China work from books and from people who had been there firsthand, who told me what they saw and smelled and everything. And I used all of that and incorporated it.
Well, it's a kind of a great segue, because speaking of going, you just came back from a place that was extremely exciting, that you and David Morrell and James Rollins and Andy Harp all had a great chance to go visit. Can you explain to everybody exactly how honored you must have been to feel to go over there to the Middle East, and exactly what it was like and what you did?
It was an honor, truly was. For the very first time, the USO sent a contingent of thriller writers into a war zone. It's never been done before. And they get sports personalities and celebrities and actresses, cheerleaders. They get all kinds of people coming over there, but they've never had writers. And so we went, and it was great. They just loved it. Reading is a big deal over there. It's what probably their number one pastime. And they wanted to talk about books, and they wanted to talk about writing, and they wanted to talk about craft. And we met with a lot of people. We went to their units, sat down with them all day long. We, in the dining facilities, they came to us, and we sat down with them. It was a long 6 days in country from dawn to midnight every day. But we loved it. It was just wonderful to do. It was great to tell them thank you. It was great to deal with them and speak to them. And we also went to Bethesda Naval Hospital and Walter Reed and saw the severely injured. That was extremely inspiring and very moving, and they were very grateful that we came as well. So Operation Thriller was a great success. We went into Kuwait City, to Baghdad, to Mosul, to Balad, to Basra, and we had a good run all the way through Iraq. It was very successful, so much so that they're talking already about Thriller 2 for next year.
And, you know, and I would have to say that a writer is probably, like yourself, the best to put it in perspective for people to understand exactly what is it like over there, you know, without sugarcoating or anything else. You know, how are they dealing with everything that they're dealing with?
Well, they're dealing with it very fine. They're very professional. That's the one thing that struck me the whole time. Every single troop down from the private up to the general, we talked to the second in command of the entire theater, all of them extremely professional, extremely conscientious of their job, very, very well disciplined in what they do, courteous, respectful. Everything about it, you know, was just as professional as you could be. And that's what, you know, it struck us all that way, the professionalism that the United States Army, United States Air Force, and we even got to see some Navy guys that were there in some places, and of course the Marines, which were scattered all over, all of them extremely proud to have them as part of the United States military.
And what did you guys bring with you? Did you guys bring, like, some of your books over there? Did you see what they were reading? You know, what did you guys bring, like, with you? What did you guys see?
I wish we could have brought books, but it was not possible because of weight restrictions. We took them to the hospital and gave them away because that was here in the United States and we could do it. But over there, shipping stuff into a war zone is very, very hard to do, so we weren't able to do it. What we did do was sign their books. We signed all the books in the USO centers and the rec centers. We did the best we could with what we had available. We even signed a bunch of Kindles, a lot of Kindles over there. We signed the back of those, some Nooks. We signed the back of those. And mainly just did a lot of talking about books and stories and writing.
What was, like, the number one thing that they, like, wanted to hear from you? Like, how did they want to pick your guys' brain?
Well, they wanted a lot of them were writers, and they had it in their, you know, they had that little voice in their head. They wanted to know, how do I do this? How do I put this story down? How do I structure it? How do I set it up to do? And we sat there and we went through it with them and did it. Others wanted to just talk about books in general and our stories and characters, and we talked about that with them. Each group was very different, and we tried to accommodate ourselves to whatever would make them happy.
Yeah, and so that definitely has to be, without a doubt. I mean, I don't know if that would be, you know, probably the highlight of, I mean, it's not, you didn't write about it, but is that probably one of the most highlights of, like, being an author for your writing career, to be able to go over there and do that?
It certainly is up at the very top of some things in my entire lifetime. It was quite incredible. We were riding on C-130s every day. We were wearing body armor. We were in a war zone in Mosul. There was things going on there. That's still a hotbed of activity. We watched these guys and women, a lot of men and women, a lot of women over there serving side by side. We watched them every day, and it was just an honor to be a part of it. We were just all looking at each other like, we can't believe we're actually here and participating in this.
Yeah, and just real quick, how exactly did they, you know, how exactly were you picked to be able to come over? Did they go to ITW? Is that how they got a hold of you guys?
They came to ITW. They gave us a list of people they'd love to have. We went down the list, and we got, you know, the yeses. I was fortunate to be on the list.
Yeah, I mean, that's just absolutely fascinating. I want to remind everybody, too, steveberry.org is your website, and your book is out today, The Emperor's Tomb.
Emperor's Tomb.
And the one thing that you have on your website, too, is you have a podcast that you have on here. Now, was this something that you – did you podcast from over there or
no.
did you have – okay.
We did here. We did everything here with that. Those are really craft podcasts. We have been blogging. If you go to the Huffington Post, we wrote a report every day about our event. You can go to the Huffington Post and find those. And then right now on Larry King's blog, we just posted 5 essays. We each wrote a very personal essay about what happened over there. So they could check out Larry King's blog and the Huffington Post if they want to get some firsthand accounts of what happened.
And so your podcast, like you said, they're pretty much all about writing or a little blurbs about your books and things like that that you have out there, right, that people
mainly
can listen
craft,
to.
Yeah, talk about mainly craft and that type of thing, that I record those. Real challenge to do those because they're like a minute, minute and a half. I say them with no script, and I have to say them perfectly. I can't have any huhs or wells or hesitations or anything. I have to say it right out, 1 minute, minute and a half, no script, no reading, right off the top of my head. And it's a challenge. To do a 1.5 minute podcast takes me about 20 minutes.
That's more challenging than be able to hit the delete button, isn't it, on your computer?
Yeah, I mean, because I have to say it straight through. I can't hesitate. I'll get right to the end, and I'll stutter one time. I have to start all over.
You're like, oh, God, there we go.
Yeah.
So, now, ITW, again, that's International Thriller Writers, and we were fortunate enough to finally meet you in person, having, you know, been talking with you with the magazine for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And Thriller Fest, and you're a big thing at Thriller Fest. And that's coming up again in July. And a lot of authors are always contacting me to sit there and say, what exactly is Thriller Fest and why should I go? What's the number one thing you should tell aspiring authors? Why should you show up or join ITW so they can, you know, have the benefit of it?
Because it's the place to be. It's, if you're going to be a thriller writer in this business, ITW is the place to be. It's the gathering. It's the, ITW is the thriller writers, or, you know, professional writers organization of thriller writers, 1,500 thriller writers around the world, so the biggest guys in the business. Thriller Fest is our gathering each year. It's like summer camp for thriller writers. If you're going to be a thriller writer, come participate in Craft Fest on Wednesday and Thursday, where some of the best in the business are teaching craft. Then Agent Fest is Thursday afternoon, where we have 40 of the biggest agents in the world there, because we do it in New York where they're located, and we've had a lot of sign-ups from Agent Fest, and we've had half a dozen or more six-figure deals for some of those folks. Agent Fest is a big deal if you want to advance your career. Then Friday and Saturday is Thriller Fest itself. A lot of panels, a lot of discussions, a lot of talk about thrillers. Saturday night's our banquet when we give the awards out each year for the best thrillers of the year. So this is the place to be if you're a thriller writer. You can go to thrillerfest.org and check it all out. And I'd recommend you come. It's, you know, we get a lot of writers who are right on the cusp. They just need a little kick forward to make it happen. And Thriller Fest has provided that kick for a lot of those people.
Yeah, when we were there, we saw a lot of people that either had one book out or they were just getting to that one book and trying to get it going, because what I guess the biggest thing that ITW does is hopefully doesn't have it to where the road is as long as like yours, which was 12 years,
yeah.
85 rejections you mentioned, 5 separate manuscripts. I mean, you had to be at a point in your writing career coming up to 2002 where you were like, this is just not going to happen for me, because you didn't have an organization that helped you out like that.
Well, we didn't have ITW. ITW was born out of the Da Vinci Code and the rebirth of our genre in 2003 is when it was born. I didn't have that. I didn't have an agent fest where I could go in and pitch my book to 40 agents face-to-face, 3 minutes to talk to these guys. I did it the old-fashioned way with query letters where you have 3 seconds to catch their attention. To do, but I was fortunate to get an agent. I actually caught a break and got one, but it still took another 7 years, 85 rejections before we finally sold the manuscript. So, you know, for me, it would have been great to have something like Thriller Fest. Thriller Fest is the premier gathering of the thriller writers of the world. It's now becoming one of the premier writers' conferences in the world as well, because of the great Craft Fest, the great Agent Fest, and everything that goes along with it. Yes, it's in New York. Yes, you have to spend a little money to come, but you have to decide what is your career worth? What's it worth to advance it? And sometimes you have to make that investment in it. I can assure you that if I'd have had that years ago, I would have gone.
Right. And, you know, and there's still a lot of, you know, less expensive ways to go. I mean, like when we come, we stayed in New Jersey. We took the train up. We didn't, you know, you don't have to spend the $500 hotel night to sit there. You can do many different things to do.
And the conference is very reasonable.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, very reasonable because you get so much. You got like three or four meals included in that. You got all kinds of refreshment and food all during the day. You got a lot of stuff included with your registration at Thriller Fest.
Yeah, where else can you spend, you know, a couple hundred dollars to be able to listen and pick the brains of, like, yourself and, you know, David Morrell and, you know, Andrew Gross and, you know, people that have been there and are telling you, this is what you need to do in order to make it. This is your path. We went through the hard path. Don't take the hard path. Take the easy path.
Yeah.
Is it worth a couple, you know, maybe $1,000 to do it? Because like you said, what is your career worth?
What's your career? You have to decide what's it worth. You have to make an investment. We hold Thriller Fest in New York simply because it is the center of the publishing world. And if you're going to be published, let's go to where the center is. Let's go to the epicenter where we can get the right people there. Last year we had Gina Centrello, who is the chief operating officer of Random House Publishing Group,
yep.
A huge organization. Came and spoke at the luncheon. We get Al Zuckerman, who's one of the premier agents, create one of the biggest agencies in all of writing, Writer's House. They are speaking to it. We get the guys and the girl and the women who are running this industry at Thriller Fest, and that's what makes it special.
Right, and I'll tell you, and for a lot of people, if that wasn't enough. Because I just want to touch on this real quick, too, with you, Steve. If that was enough to know all that Steve does is, you know, writing best-selling books like The Emperor's Tomb, which came out today, you know, going overseas to do with the troops, dealing with ITW that comes in July, everything else. You have another organization that you and your wife just started called History Matters.
We do. We have a foundation.
Yeah. Can you just explain a little bit about what History Matters is?
It's a way for us to give back. We discovered all across the country and all across the world there's no money for historic preservation anymore. It is gone. So we came up with a unique way to raise money for historic preservation. And what we do is a community picks a project. We come into the community. We do a writer's workshop for the day. I teach writing for 5 hours, a very intense 5-hour class, very intense on the craft of writing. And you buy your way in with a contribution, usually between $100 and $150, and every dime of that goes to the project. I don't charge to come. I don't charge expenses. I don't charge anything. It's all donated by me. We've done 6 of these around the country now and raised a little over $40,000. I've taught 350 students. We've got 6 more scheduled for 2011 already, and we're looking at 2012 now. And here's what's really neat about it. I did one in a community. We raised $5,000, and I felt really bad because it wasn't a lot of money. And the lady said, no, you don't understand. We've got a hole in the roof of our local museum, which is a 19th-century historic building. It's destroying the building. This money is going to fix that hole and save that building. So the smallest amount of money can go a very long way. And it's our way of giving back. So if anybody out there has a project that we think we could help with, go to steveberry.org, click on History Matters, and send us an email, and we'll see if we can help you out.
Well, Steve, I'll tell you what, and you did all that in the same breath because you have been very busy, man, and you're still very busy, and it's great to see, you know, everything that you're doing as far as giving back to the community and giving back, you know, your craft of writing. I mean, a 5-hour lesson to sit with you for $100, $150 to be able to also have 100% of all that money go towards something that matters. That is just absolutely amazing. And the one thing that my producer wanted to know too, real quick, isn't it a tax write-off for the authors that go to Thriller Fest? I mean, they can write that off too, can't they?
If they have income, you can. The IRS, you can't write off against income. But if you have income from your writing, yes, that would be a deduction that you could do. But if you don't derive any income from it, no.
So there you go. See, if anybody has any income from it, you can write off the whole thing and be able to sit down with these great authors. Well, Steve, I know it's late. We've taken up enough of your time. We really appreciate it. The Emperor's Tomb came out today. Go get it. SteveBerry.org. Steve, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we will talk with you soon. Have a great night.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, everybody, Steve Berry, New York Times bestselling author. The Emperor's Tomb came out today. Go pick it up. It's in bookstores everywhere. Kindle, ebook format, everywhere. The Balkan Escape, like he mentioned, it's a little 6,000-word thing. It fills a hole for Cassiopeia Vitt, one of his characters. You can download that right now. So there's a lot of options. You have a lot of Christmas gifts that you can go out and get, and we would definitely say The Emperor's Tomb, that one that needs to be in the stocking, needs to be a big stocking, and one that you can anchor to the ground, because it is a hardback book and it's going to be a little heavy. Excuse me again. But our next author is another one that you can couple hand in hand with The Emperor's Tomb here, because we want to thank so much for our next author coming on, which is Joel Fox. He is the author of Lincoln's Hand. We've not spoken with Joel before. So, Joel, thank you so much for joining us on Suspense Radio.
Thanks for having me, John. Pleasure to be here.
So, Lincoln's Hand, it's a Zane Rigby mystery. Can you kind of explain a little bit about Lincoln's Hand, what it is, and things of that nature? And I want to remind everybody, Lincoln's Hand.com is the website. So don't go to JoelFox.com, because that ain't it. It's Lincoln'sHand.com is the website, so that's how people can find you.
That's right. Lincoln's Hand is a modern-day mystery, but it has a historical catalyst. And I base it on a actual fact that there was an attempt to steal Abraham Lincoln's body 11 years after he was buried in 1876. And ultimately it led to those who were in charge of Lincoln's tomb were concerned that there may be another grave robbing, and they moved the coffin around many times over the years. So while visitors were coming to look at the sarcophagus, thinking the president's remains were within the sarcophagus, they were actually someplace else in the tomb. At one time, covered with logs and wood, sitting on the surface of the ground under the terrace for 2 years. At another time, buried under the terrace for 9 years. Moved around a number of times, and actually opened. The coffin was opened twice, John, in 1887 and 1901, to see if the body was there. And that led me to the question, is Lincoln's body in his tomb, and why are people dying to find out? So that was the catalyst for my mystery, but it's a modern-day mystery with an FBI agent who was assigned to find out if, because of new evidence, if Lincoln is indeed in his tomb. We end up with a murder in the cemetery. There is a terrorist bomber running around that he would love to catch, but because he hasn't been able to catch him, our agent has been reassigned to this case of Lincoln's body in the tomb, and that's something he's disgruntled about, but he runs into a lot of interesting characters in Springfield, Illinois, where most of the book takes place, and of course that's where Lincoln's buried.
Now, you know, that's the one thing that I always found fascinating. I believe I was 12 years old when I first went to Mount Vernon, and you can stand, I mean, you're literally 2, maybe 4 feet away from George and Martha Washington's, coffin sitting there. And I'm like, you want to talk about almost like a time period to go in history. You're standing next to someone who died in 1799 right there, but are they in there? You know, or is it just, you know, but it's like a time, it's kind of like a time warp. I mean, because you're standing right next to George Washington. Now we know he's dead, but is he in there or is he not in there or what happened? So this is kind of the same thing that you thought of.
Well, in fact, I think, I'm not positive about this, John, but I think the Washington's body was moved at one time, too, from where it was originally buried.
Oh, well, see, that just killed me.
Yeah.
Because I thought I could touch his coffin.
because of the grave robbing attempt, Robert Lincoln, who was the only son of Abraham Lincoln to live to adulthood, demanded his father be buried 10 feet below the surface in a wire cage with concrete poured in it. Which I take into account in my mystery, but there was that kind of concern that another grave robbing attempt would occur.
And so now, basically, I want people to know. So it's more along the lines of maybe not a urban myth, but it's a fictional story that you put out of why or what is inside Lincoln's tomb, almost like, you know, who's buried in Grant's tomb. Well, I guess maybe we can say Abraham Lincoln. But, you know. But
that would be a good twist.
Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
So that's the answer to the question. Who's buried in Grant's tomb? Abraham Lincoln. But,
now, don't give it away now, John.
No. But so the thing is that is kind of, you know, it's a fictional thing where you're saying, you know, this is kind of the story of why you think Abraham Lincoln is there or not there or whatever, or the whole story behind it.
I was able to take a historical event, which was the grave robbing attempt, and the aftermath of the grave robbing attempt, in which the body was moved around, the coffin opened a couple of times, and weave that into a mystery to make it the catalyst of a mystery of whether he's in the tomb and everything that surrounds that, of people who are concerned that the tomb be opened or not, or people concerned that maybe he's not in there and who might have taken the body. So there are all those elements that play out in this mystery, along with the FBI agent who has to deal with the modern-day menace of someone who's blowing up monuments, American monuments. Earlier in the book, where the agent has not been able to successfully capture this person, and so he gets this reassignment. Many years ago, when I was a young boy, I watched this B-Hollywood movie, I guess you'd call it, called The Abductors, starring Victor McLaughlin, who won an Oscar back in the 30s, but this was toward the end of his career in the 50s. And The Abductors was the story of some men who were trying to steal Abraham Lincoln's body. And I was just outraged and aghast. I mean, how would anyone even think of that? Someone has a great imagination. And then I found out it was true. And to me, it always stuck with me as the possibility of creating a mystery around the question, is Abraham Lincoln in his tomb? And many years later, I finally got it on paper and got it published.
And did you go to Springfield, Missouri, and spend quite a bit of time there?
Springfield, Illinois.
Springfield,
yes,
Illinois.
I did.
So
yes,
you did,
I did
spend a lot of time there. Okay.
Yeah, I spent a number of days there, not quite a full week, but I spent a number of days there. I went to the historical sites, a number of the Lincoln historical sites that appear in the book. The Lincoln Presidential Library was delayed in its opening, and it plays a role in my book, but it wasn't quite open at the time. I've since been there, since the book came out a couple of months ago, I have been to the library. And they have, by the way, in the library, they have a couple of the tools used by the grave robbers on display. And I did spend a number of days there. I talked to people involved with Lincoln's history. Everything in Springfield is about Lincoln, believe me. It's the land of Lincoln, and a lot of things are named for him, a lot of historical sites. And it was a pleasure spending some time there and intensely just letting it all surround me, taking little drives into the countryside to see what it's like. And those drives ended up in the book. I was able to place characters' homes in certain areas in the Springfield area. There is a scene in Lincoln, Illinois, which was a town named after Abraham Lincoln. It's 30 miles north of Springfield. And it was named after Lincoln before he was president, because when he was in the legislature, he helped get that county developed. And there's a beautiful old courthouse there. It's actually on the historical register. It was built in the early 1900s. And because of my time there and driving around, I was able to put a scene in that courthouse, an important scene in solving the mystery. So, yes, I did spend time there, and I had a great time from morning till night, just involved with taking notes and looking at scenery and learning about Springfield.
Now, why do you think, because there's a lot of, well, not a lot, but I've seen in the recent year, I've seen a lot of different Abraham Lincoln's books that have come out on different styles. Now, you're the first one to ever, that I know, do something with his body and the grave robbing and the monument bomber. You know, that's all you. But why do you think the fascination all of a sudden with some of the Abraham Lincoln books, where they've had, you know, like vampires coming, where the guy was a vampire for Abraham
right.
Lincoln, it was a Secret Service, and, you know, all these other ones. You know, I know that he, do you think, I mean, I know that he was one of the greatest presidents of all time. That's what people say. I was never born or alive. I just know, like, what his presidency was. But do you think it's because of the conspiracy of how he died, and people still wonder, was John Wilkes Booth working for someone, or did someone hire him, or was he by himself? You know, was that it? Because you don't really hear about a lot of that. If that is, you don't hear a lot of that about Kennedy with Oswald and all that other kind of conspiracy.
Well, I think it's a number of things, John. First of all, Lincoln's 200th birthday was a year ago, and so a lot of books came out in connection to his birthday. And I think you hit on it, too. I mean, he's such a major historical figure in this country. His shadow, I think there have been more books written about Abraham Lincoln than any other individual in American history. So he still fascinates readers today. And then, as you mentioned, right now, there is a movie in development. I think it's actually been filmed, directed by Robert Redford, called The Conspirators.
Right.
And it's about the conspirators, those who assassinated Lincoln, and not just John Wilkes Booth, but some of the others who tried to kill the vice president and the secretary of war.
Now, is this a remake? Is this a remake? Because I think when I was 11 or 12 years old, there was a book, or there was a movie out kind of about that too, wasn't there?
I'm not familiar with that one, but I think this is an original script, because it's going to focus on Mary Surratt, who was the only woman who was found guilty in the conspiracy and was executed in the Lincoln assassination conspiracy. And by the way, speaking of Lincoln in the movies, Steven Spielberg has been talking about doing a new Lincoln movie, and just two or three days ago they announced that Daniel Day-Lewis will be hired to play Abraham Lincoln. And I think that movie's scheduled for about a year and a half down the road. And he's going to base that on Doris Kearns Goodwin's history on Lincoln. So you're right. I mean, Lincoln has always fascinated Americans, and I took what is, I think, a little-known historical fact about him, and that is an attempt to steal his body, which still catches me as being outrageous all these years later after doing all this research.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that presidential bodies are kept a lot more, I guess, secure than maybe that they are. I've visited, I believe, four or five different presidential houses. And, you know, I mean, they're kind of like right there. Like I said, Mount Vernon and James Monroe, Thomas Jefferson's, some of the ones around Ohio where I grew up and lived, never made out to see Abraham Lincoln or, you know, Springfield, Illinois. But I don't know. It just kind of shocked me. Do people think that they were buried with, you know, like the national treasure, like the Book of Secrets, or
this is a little bit like the national treasure here. Oh. I mean, you know, what's in the coffin? Why is it there? Is it keep a secret? I had a little story myself. In fact, I put it in my blog, which is on the website that you mentioned, lincolnshand.com. A number of years ago, I went back. I grew up in Massachusetts, and I went back with my wife and my in-laws, who were not from there. And we went to visit the tombs of Presidents John and John Quincy Adams. And they're in a crypt below a church in Quincy, Massachusetts. And at that time, and this is before the Adamses made it big with the book by David McCullough and the TV HBO miniseries, we had to search around in the dark looking for the light switch. And we turned it on to be in the crypt chamber to be able to see the sarcophagi of both the presidents and the first ladies. It was kind of an eerie experience, but there was no honor guard. There wasn't even a custodian around, just searching the crypt. So I think that these kind of situations sort of reach out to those of us who are interested in suspense and mystery, and they offer opportunities to write about some of the great men and women in history and tie it to some mysterious goings-on, and I enjoy that.
So, I guess we all have to say is, what is next for Zane Rigby and Joel Fox?
Well, it so happens that Zane Rigby has a file on his desk that is labeled FDR's Treasure.
There we go. Yeah.
And has to do with Franklin Roosevelt had a favorite destroyer in which he would take vacations and fishing trips called the USS Houston. And he would go off and a number of times, half a dozen times, visited the Cocos Islands off of the west coast of Costa Rica. And that island is famous for being supposedly visited by pirates in the early centuries. So the question I ask is, why was President Roosevelt, this was in the 30s before the war, why was President Roosevelt visiting that island so often? And what's the connection to the treasure? And is that really the reason he was there? And those questions got me started on what is going to be Zane Rigby's next mystery.
And that's good because, you know, like we just mentioned National Treasure. If you remember the end of National Treasure 2, it was, you know, can you help me with what's on page, I think it was like 67.
That's right.
Because, yeah, I think I can do that. Okay, well, what the hell was on page 67?
That's right. It keeps you guessing. And that's the whole idea of suspense, right? Keep them
right
on the edge of their seats. And,
right,
and that's what I try to do.
Let us loose.
Yeah. And that's what I try to do with Lincoln's Hand, you know, keeping the question open, what's there. And I don't want to give too much away when, you know, but I think it's safe to say they get down to the tomb and open it up.
Let's hope this is not Geraldo Rivera, though.
No, please. Believe me, no. Those who have read it have been more satisfied with
fabulous
the results of that dig.
And hopefully we can get a galley of that, you know, when it comes, you know, when they start having him out on that FDR, because we'd love to be able to have a first-chance review and be able to review it.
Absolutely.
Now, we have a question that came in from some of your fans here, is that they want to know, you know, like, you have such an extensive political background. You're here in Southern California.
Yes.
You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger told everybody to go get the book Lincoln's
Hand.
Yes,
he did.
And, you know, so what do you read?
What do I read as far as fiction?
You didn't see that one coming, did you, when I was
doing
that?
Yeah, no, I didn't. not the way you started out. You know, obviously, I assume you mean by what do I read in fiction, not necessarily what I read.
Yeah, like what do you read in fiction?
Yeah, well, I love mysteries and histories. I mean, just like what I write about, I love mysteries and histories. I recently finished Lee Child's 61 Hours and Clive Cussler's Spartan Gold. I actually read an old mystery, which became a classic movie, Laura. I don't know if you remember that from the 40s, but I got interested in reading the mystery itself, and I'll read histories. I did have to pick up Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter just because it was out there.
Yeah,
because of my writing.
Knew it.
I had to read that. But I read recently Game Change, of course, which was about the presidential election in 2008, and I've read recently Dan Brown and Michael Connelly's one of my favorites, and I read Jeff Sherratt's stuff, and you know, new writers, new mystery writers, established mystery writers, and history volumes, a lot of history I like.
Now, was there one book in particular way back when that kind of changed your life? Because did you always know that you wanted to be a writer, or was it something that came later in your life that you said that something that you wanted to write? Or was it one book that changed you that wanted to do that?
Well, I know I always wanted to try to be a writer for a long time. I don't think I wrote enough. One self-criticism I would have is I didn't produce enough work over all the years. Obviously, like many other writers, I have some unpublished novels in the drawer, and my wife encourages me occasionally to pull them out because she thinks they're still workable, and maybe I will someday, but I'm excited about
those,
the Zane Rigby series.
And are those
so
historical fictions that you have written down?
Yes. One is based around President Warren Harding. So, yeah, that's
an Ohio guy from Marion. Yes,
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 yes. Yeah, I visited his tomb, too, one day. Yeah. So that's what I've wanted to write. Now, there was a writer who writes a lot of New England historical and modern-day mysteries, William Martin. Back Bay was one book that really caught my attention many years ago, and he's had a number since then, Cape Cod, a few others. And his work, he goes differently than mine. My only chapter that's in the past is the prologue. And then the rest of it's modern-day mystery, but, of course, it dips into history to help solve the mystery. Martin had one chapter in the past that took place in the past, the next chapter that took place in the present, and then he went back and forth in laying the foundation for what would be disclosed in modern times, laying the foundation in the historical chapters, one to the other. But it fascinated me at the time, and I think that was one book that really moved me toward writing this genre.
Our producer wants to ask a question here. They would like to know. They want to know if you're writing full-time now, and this is how they put it, so I'm going to read it. Or are you still dabbling in our crazy California political arena?
Yeah, well, I recently was at an event called the Men of Mystery, in which they invited 50 mystery writers, and they had an audience about 400. We had about a minute or so to talk about ourselves in our book. And I started my presentation by saying, and this was about 5 days before the election, and I said, I'm probably going to get in trouble for telling you this, but I've been involved in California politics for 30 years. But I come with good news. It's almost over. And the election was a few days later. No, I make my living still in the political arena, sad to say, in tough times. But no, I'm still writing on the side and still involved in politics and consulting as a full-time profession.
But, you know, the good thing is that it seems, because it sounds like you said, you have a Herbert Hoover book. You know, you're going to be working here on FDR. You have Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably, I mean, to go back and look, I mean, it's a very good idea or a very good story that you have here with Abraham Lincoln and others. I bet every president has some kind of secret that needs to be let out, because presidents are very secretive in nature. They have to be.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's the basis of my mysteries. Take a small, maybe not major, and that's what I'm looking for, not a major event. Obviously, the grave robbing was startling even today, but it was past his presidency. It didn't affect his presidency. Or FDR using this destroyer to go to fishing near this treasure island a number of times. Take these kernels of a strange event of a past presidential, president's history, and weave that into a mystery. That's the goal of what I'm trying to do with my Zane Rigby mysteries. And as you point out, John, I think there is a wealth of opportunity to do so, because presidents have all of these little side stories, strange events, secrets that have come out over the past number of years since they left office. So I think there's an opportunity to have a nice, good, strong series here.
Yeah, and not to mention just a matter of, you know, I mean, you know that probably 95% of America and Americans today can probably only name you, you know, eight past presidents of the United States. That's probably their limitations when you get over the first four or first five that everybody can sit there and say, you know, Washington, you know, and Adams and Jefferson and Monroe and Madison, you know, and then John Quincy Adams. But do you think that this will also bring about a good resurgence, kind of like the Da Vinci Code did with, you know, its resurgence, whether it was good or bad, of how it did, you know, the resurgence of what Zane Rigby and what Joel Fox can do in the history of the United States and learning about these presidents that people might have forgotten about?
You know, you've raised a very interesting question that I've wrestled with. I've taken, obviously, the first president I've dealt with is Abraham Lincoln. Everybody knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
My second president, FDR, I think it's safe to say everybody knows who he is. Mm-hmm. So where do I go from there? Do I go to a John Kennedy? Do I go to a George Washington? Or do I go to a Franklin Pierce when everyone says, who? Is that a good opportunity? Is that a good president to market, if you will? I'm actually wrestling with that. I'd love to know what your input would be, but you've raised a question that I have actually wondered whether you go to a president. And I think you can do it once you establish the series. I think if I establish the series with a couple of presidents, or maybe three presidents that people would recognize and are interested in, and then if they're comfortable, the reader, with the series, with Zane Rigby and how he grows through the series and how he investigates these crimes and brings out the history, then they may be interested to know about Zane Rigby finding out what happened in Franklin Pierce's background or Martin Van Buren's background. And I think that's the way it'll develop. But I think it's an excellent question because I've been wrestling with it for a little time now.
Yeah, and I tell you what, we could talk about that for hours, and maybe that's something that we should do maybe off the air.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, I kind of give my input of what I feel. But another question that just came in right when we were just talking about that is, would it be pushing the limits to go towards a living president, not necessarily a sitting president, but a living president?
You know, that's another good question, and one I've thought about, and I think I'd be more comfortable with a president who is no longer with us.
Because George Bush just put out his book.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah.
But remember, the theme of this
yeah, it's the mystery, yeah. Right.
It's a mystery. It's an FBI agent who's digging up the past. It's very much in the national treasure genre, where you're taking secrets from the past to solve something that happens today and uncovering those secrets and getting it involved in a modern mystery. And I think if you're dealing with a president either in office or who's still alive but out of office, I think that's a different story to me. And so I don't think I'll go there. I know you're never supposed to say never, so I won't. But to me, I don't think I'd go in that direction. I think I stick with a historical event that my FBI agent, Zane Rigby, can uncover the meaning of that historical event while he's solving the modern-day mystery.
Right. Or more along the lines of you're solving the Andrew Jackson mystery and George Bush is the one who knows something about it and is trying to hide it during his presidency or
something.
Well,
that could be a way to bring in the modern-day president.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know,
that's an interesting idea.
Hey, and you know what? I mean, the Rangers just lost the World Series. He's no longer president. He's got time to talk.
I'll give him a call, see what he has to say.
Well, I'll tell you what, Joel, I mean, it's been fascinating. We have definitely run out of time, but I would like if you could email me at editor@suspensemagazine.com, you know, and we would talk further about anything that you'd like to. That would be fabulous.
I'd love to. I would love to, John. I think we're pretty close to each other.
Well, I'll tell you, I live off of Las Virgenes and Lost Hills, so
You know, I teach a class at Pepperdine once.
Exactly.
So I can drop off on my way by.
Exactly. See, then that's good. And my daughter might be going to Pepperdine.
She's great. Well, then we should have a talk. I'll be happy to email you, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you tonight. Real pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much, everybody. So, Joel, you have a great night, and we appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk to you later, Joel.
All right. So, everybody, that was Joel Fox with Lincoln's Hand. That's lincolnshand.com. It is the first in the Zane Rigby Mystery Series. Definitely a book you want to go check out. We've had two fabulous authors on here for you tonight, starting with Steve Barry and The Emperor's Tomb, and now Joel Fox with Lincoln's Hand. Both books that you can put down as Christmas presents for the person who loves historical thrillers and likes to understand, you know, what's going on, you know, with the past coming to the present. And what better way than to start out with Abraham Lincoln here with Joel Fox and then to go over to China and get Steve Barry with The Emperor's Tomb, you know, to bring those two societies together. And I want to remind everybody, you know, again, we will not be a show coming up the day after Thanksgiving. We are going to take that off, and I want to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving to you and your families. You can please email us with any questions or comments. You know, we will have our next show is going to be the 30th of November, with Patricia Cornwell coming on, and she is going to be on there with Michelle Gagan. So you definitely want to make sure that you check that show out. That's going to be, you know, one of our best ones that we've had here in a long time. So it's great to have everybody on with us again. We will see everybody next Tuesday. Check out suspensemagazine.com. Our magazine will be out here the week after Thanksgiving. It's our best of edition for December 2010. The year is now going to be gone, and we are working on January's feverishly right now with Stuart Woods, Jeffrey Deaver, and also Brad Metzler are featured in that magazine. So everybody, thank you so much. Enjoy your Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, and see you all on Tuesday night. Good night.